It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The village of Whitefish Bay in Milwaukee's North Shore suburbs declared a public emergency this week after residents found a 30-foot sinkhole at a park there.
On Tuesday, the village made the declaration to speed up repairs and protect public health. WITI-TV in Milwaukee spoke with resident Jane Collins.
I walked on that path exactly where the sinkhole is at 8:15 the night before it happened.
We'll find out about the village's plans to update aging stormwater infrastructure. Then a member of the American Society of Civil Engineers tells us about the condition of sewer systems around the state.
Joining us now from Whitefish Bay is the Director of Public Works, Matt Collins. Matt, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, good morning.
Good morning. Can you describe for us what this sinkhole looks like?
Absolutely. So this is an active construction site as we speak. So first and foremost, we are extremely thankful that no one was hurt with this incident, and public safety is our primary objective with this one. So as we start to look at short-term fixes and then long-term results, we just are asking the public to just be mindful that this is an active construction site. We have our fencing put in place. But yeah, we are thankful that as that happened, is it's a highly utilized park and pathway, that we're just thankful that everyone's safe as we try to look at how to resolve this storm sewer collapse that happened within Big Bay and Buckley Park.
Were there any witnesses reported, or was anyone injured in this sinkhole?
No one was injured, and we had quick confirmation within our police department and neighbors that had their Ring security systems pointed in that general vicinity. So we were able to confirm pretty quickly that no one was on site as far as over that sinkhole when it did collapse. So we are thankful that we were able to make sure we had temporary fencing up very quickly. And now we're just working on emergency repairs just to have more of that stormwater flow exit to Lake Michigan while we work on more permanent solutions.
Can you describe the infrastructure here, the storm sewer, and the age of it and how it failed?
Absolutely. No, thanks for asking that. So I'll back into it. Whitefish Bay is the second densest population per capita within the state of Wisconsin. So if you can imagine how dense with residential, types of urban environments, we really depend on a stormwater system and a storm sewer system to take care of any impervious surface to go into that utility infrastructure. Within the village, we have seven different basins, and within one of the seven basins, it drains directly into Lake Michigan. So if you can almost envision how the normal environment works, where you have ditches go into creeks, creeks go into rivers, rivers go into either a lake or any body of water. The same thing was designed over 100 years ago for the village of Whitefish Bay to take care of all that storm water underground. So within one of these basins, where all that convergence happens with all the underground pipe system, that's where we had a failed collapse of that storm sewer. So unfortunately, it's where everything comes to a head based on that slope. And it's supposed to go out to Lake Michigan, but there's a manhole that collects all that basin within one area within that section, the southeastern section of our village. And 70 feet deep, there was a collapse of that main storm sewer. And when it collapsed 70 feet deep, what happened is the earth kept on eroding all the way down until you actually had a collapse on top where you had that 30-foot sinkhole. So the real challenge for the village right now is how to get down 70 feet in order to make those necessary repairs. So it's almost like a two-phase approach that we have emergency repairs going on as we speak with contractors and engineers to get some positive flow, because that water has to go somewhere with the next rainfall event. So there's a sense of urgency to take care of emergency repairs right now to get that storm water out into exit Lake Michigan. But that doesn't mean we're done. We have to actually fix where that collapse happened 70 feet deep. So it's almost going to be a two-phase approach that we have emergency measures going on right now. But that doesn't mean that we don't have a sense of urgency to actually make permanent repairs to that stormwater basin so we can actually get that system up and running. Because this
Matt,
yeah, go ahead, please.
I just want to ask here, you know, this could be costly, and addressing really aging infrastructure nearly a century old. And I'm wondering what your village is looking at for costs and going forward, how you would bring this sewer system up to, you know, the standards today.
Those are really good questions. Absolutely. So in regards to the age of the system, you're absolutely correct. When we have a village that's over 100 years old, we do have an aging system. That doesn't mean that we don't do necessary inspections and repairs as needed with not only storm sewer, but your water mains. You have your sanitary systems that are all tied to these utilities. So we do what we can with ongoing inspection, maintenance, and repairs. But something to that depth is very unique to this area at the same time. So it's going to be something that's going to be exploratory with this immediate issue. But then as it relates to cost, we're not even there yet. Our primary objective right now is to get a pipe in the ground and to make sure before the next storm happens that we get that water out of the community. Because if we don't do that, then you're talking about flooded streets, and we don't want that to happen. So at the same time, we just want to get over this first hump, and we're hoping to get a system in place by today and this weekend, and then we're prepared for the actual storm system coming through.
Matt,
and then when it comes to cost, we're going to have to determine that with our engineers.
As it goes, Matt, thank you for bringing us up to speed here. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it as well.
Matt Collins, Director of Public Works with the Village of Whitefish Bay, as we talk about Wisconsin's sewer infrastructure after the village begins repairs to a sinkhole there. Now we go to Ken Mica, Regional Director for the American Society of Civil Engineers, member of the ASCE's National Board. Ken, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me. Looking forward to our discussion.
We are hearing about this sewer line failure that is, you know, a 90-year-old infrastructure, 30-foot sinkhole. What do you think of this type of a failure here?
It's not a surprise to hear of a failure like this with America's aging infrastructure and the funding that's not there to keep America's infrastructure going, that these types of situations are happening all over the United States. So it's not surprising at all. In 2020, the American Society of Civil Engineers Wisconsin members gave Wisconsin stormwater infrastructure a C, which the national grade was a D. And C being, you know, it's not meeting today's standards, and D meaning that we need to do some investments as soon as possible. So hearing that a 100-year-old storm sewer is still in place when the geographic area has changed quite a bit and we've seen increases in stormwater events, it's just a combination of those two things causes these types of situations to occur.
Geographic areas change quite a bit. Are there areas of Wisconsin's geography that could be more susceptible to sinkholes?
I would say that based on the geography itself, no. It's just a general practice when you start populating areas more and more, and there's becoming less impervious surface for water to infiltrate into the ground. The stormwater is going to have to go somewhere, and so putting it into sewer systems and other areas is key, storage ponds as well work to help manage some of the stormwater flow. But when you start having aging infrastructure and as water will do what it does, and that is it'll go to the easiest path or the path of least resistance. If the infrastructure is aging, you know, cracks will open up in the piping systems, and then that will start pushing soil around the pipe, and then you start having sinkholes like it just had happened this last week.
Can a sinkhole release underground gases? Are there any issues there with, like, methane, for instance?
The only time that you might have a situation with gases would be related to an actual gas pipeline in the area because of the soil around the one pipe loosening up and flowing to another location. That could also erode if there's a nearby gas pipe or a natural gas pipeline. That could erode soil around that gas pipeline, too, which can cause issues as well. So usually you won't have any of those issues unless you're in a jet, you have a sinkhole in the area, both of a stormwater pipe and a natural gas line.
What solutions are engineers turning to and developing to address, you know, aging wastewater infrastructure around Wisconsin?
Well, one of the big things is how do we make the current infrastructure last longer? Mm-hmm. There hasn't been enough funding over the years to provide to support all of America's aging infrastructure. Now, granted, Wisconsin received about $7 billion from the IIJA, and for that was passed in November 2021, and water systems received nearly $1 billion. But that amount of money, while it seems like a lot, that was just a small amount to help take care of the overarching issue with Wisconsin's infrastructure in general. You know, so looking at trying to divert water from going into piping systems, if we can keep it more at the surface or help it slowly infiltrate into the ground and help depleted groundwater aquifers. In addition, with the pipe networks that are there, there are some opportunities where we could line the inside of the pipes to help prevent any sort of leaks from occurring. But the best course of action is when there is funding available is to reevaluate the size of the system and then replace as needed, to ensure that the piping system underground is able to take the full capacity of what's being provided to it from the surface.
And the density of how many people live in an area would also, I would imagine, impact the type of infrastructure you need to replace it with.
Absolutely. The greater the density, the more type of the greater infrastructure need is for that area, especially in urban settings where residents are packed together and you have mostly smaller lots with homes and driveways and garages and sidewalks and roads. There's very little green space for the water to infiltrate into the ground. And so that's really when you need to start finding different sewer systems or stormwater ponds to help manage the stormwater coming from the environment.
Well, Ken, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Not a problem. Thank you.
That was Ken Micah, who is a regional director for the American Society of Civil Engineers. He's also a member of its national board. And earlier, we talked with the Village of Whitefish Bay's public works director, Matt Collins.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, college students from Milwaukee take a trip to Israel and the West Bank, getting a closer perspective on the war in Gaza. We'll talk to the nonprofit Hillel Milwaukee about their experiences. That's up next on WPR News.
This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Milwaukee County had the lowest per capita count of unsheltered homeless people in the nation. That's according to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development's numbers 3 years ago.
But as Evan Casey reports, the county has seen that number increase, which is worrying local experts and advocates.
It's a Thursday evening in Milwaukee County, and volunteers with the Street Angels are slowly filing onto a small white bus. Before they leave their office, Director Shelley Saracen says a nonprofit is planning to see around 200 homeless people across Milwaukee County tonight.
And that's between two buses, so that's about 12 hours of outreach between the two of us. And we do that three nights a week.
Saracen says they started to see more people living on the streets last summer, and it hasn't slowed down since.
We did not start seeing over 200 people until August of 2023, which is insane.
I love you.
The buses are about the size of an airport shuttle. Inside, the seats are filled with tubs of clothes, bottles of water, boxes of food. After a bumpy ride, the vehicle comes to a stop on an unassuming street on Milwaukee's north side. Hidden behind an alley, a large encampment of unsheltered homeless people are living on a small hill next to the train tracks. And one by one, about 15 people line up next to the bus. They're seeking clothes, tents, and food.
There you go, darling. Anything else?
Wet wipes. Do you have any?
Wet wipes.
I always forget that one.
Hell yeah.
You thank you.
You're welcome. Have a good night.
28-year-old Ileana Hagen has been homeless on and off for about 4 years following a breakup with her ex-boyfriend.
I didn't want to run home to mom and dad. I wanted to feel independent, so
And here I am sleeping on pavement with a cardboard box as a wall.
She's not alone. The homeless population in Milwaukee County and across Wisconsin has risen in the past few years. Street Angels encountered around 300 unsheltered people on one night last year, the highest number they've ever seen in their eight-year history. During the COVID-19 pandemic, many communities got millions in federal aid. Some, including Milwaukee County, used that money to get homeless people into hotel rooms and emergency shelters. And it worked, at least for a while. But that money has mostly dried up. Eric Collins-Dyke is the Assistant Administrator of Supportive Housing and Homeless Services for Milwaukee County.
I think a dream would be to have that level of funding at all times, not just during the pandemic, because we saw how effective it was.
After those additional funds were used up, some people were left back on the street. Experts say a lack of affordable housing isn't helping. An analysis by Realtor.com found Milwaukee had some of the fastest rising rents in the Midwest. In March, the Wisconsin Policy Forum found the homeless population across the state had been declining before the pandemic, but it's slowly risen in the years since. In 2023, Wisconsin had just over 4,800 homeless people living across the state. That's a nearly 2% increase over the year before, according to data from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. One solution, Milwaukee County's outreach team tries to get people into permanent housing. Like the Street Angels, their team does regular rounds. Early one morning in April, they head out from the office downtown. More and more often, they're seeing people living in their cars. On this morning, they locate a tent by the river near American Family Field.
Morning, Milwaukee County, almost outreach. Oh, good morning, how are you?
Collins-Dyke says they hope these connections can help them get through to those who need their services. But it can be a hard population to reach. Ileana Hagen says she was excited when she learned she was approved for a county housing program.
I started jumping up and down. I wanted to hug the guy.
But in recent weeks, outreach workers said they haven't heard from her. They hope that means she found somewhere safe to go. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today.
A dozen college students in Wisconsin have fresh eyes on the Israel-Hamas war. The students from Marquette University and UW-Milwaukee traveled to Israel recently, visiting a settlement in the West Bank, touring holy sites in Jerusalem, and hearing firsthand accounts by the Israeli military about the Hamas October 7th attack.
The nonprofit organization Hillel Milwaukee sponsors this 10-day trip called Side by Side, and we learn more about their experiences in Israel with Owen Ward, a junior at UW-Milwaukee. Owen, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
And Rabbi Joshua Herman is executive director of Hillel Milwaukee. That's an organization supporting Jewish college students and young adults. Rabbi Herman, welcome.
Thanks for having me, too.
Rabbi Herman, let's start with you. Hillel Milwaukee led this trip to Israel. What are the goals of this trip?
Sure. This is a trip that we've taken every year for the last number of years. And the goals of the trip are really just to introduce students and teach a little bit more deeply to the conflict in the Middle East, to learn about the conflict from as many different perspectives as possible, and hopefully to bring that learning back to campus, not necessarily with any answers, but with an appreciation for the complexity and really for the human impact on both sides, to try to encourage the conversations and the dialogue on campus to be a little bit more nuanced and thoughtful.
Certainly now, amid this war, this year's trip, I would imagine, was a lot more complex and certainly difficult. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, the complexity started just in trying to recruit students. You know, we considered, should we cancel the trip, but thought that given the challenges and complexities, it was all the more important to take the trip. And we actually took a much smaller group of students than we normally do, just because it was, you know, hard to reassure everyone that it was safe, despite the fact that we changed the itinerary to sort of maintain safety as the highest priority. And in addition, you know, we couldn't go certain places that we would normally go on the trip. You know, that sort of affected the trip as well. And, you know, we saw a country and spoke to people that are, you know, really in the midst of experiencing trauma. We went and met with, you know, survivors of the October 7th attack at the Nova Music Festival. We met with first responders. And really heard some of the sort of raw emotions. And on the other side as well, we you know, had a Zoom session with a Palestinian who normally we would have met with in person, but because of the security situation, we couldn't get to him. He couldn't get to us. And that, you know, in and of itself was kind of demonstrating the challenges of doing this kind of learning and having this kind of dialogue right now.
Owen, as a college student, what was it like for you to travel to Israel at this time? And can you tell us about your experiences?
It was actually more worry-free than I thought it would be to travel to Israel this time. You know, obviously, I was a little bit concerned, and my parents were definitely a little bit concerned when I like told them that I was thinking about going on the trip. But I thought that it went rather smoothly. And it was a really nice, like, it was a very nice experience to go on. I'm very grateful that I got the opportunity to go.
Part of this trip, you visited a settlement in the West Bank. Can you describe what it was like and what you saw?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it was kind of more or less what I would expect, but it was pretty, like, it was pretty eye-opening, and I feel like I kind of got the different perspective that I was more or less like looking for when signing up for the trip.
And Rabbi Herman, what was this settlement like for people amidst this conflict and being on the western border of the West Bank?
Sure. I mean, the settlement that we visited is called Al-Sfei Menashed. It's sort of... I think maybe a unique place is not a terribly religious community. It's a little bit different than what people tend to think of as a West Bank settlement. And, you know, we only spoke briefly with some of the folks that lived there. And I think they felt kind of similar to everyone else. And, you know, while we were there, we sort of looked and you know, from the vantage point of that area, you can see, you know, the narrowest part of Israel that's only about, you know, 8 or 9 miles wide. And just sort of see the geographic challenges in, you know, addition to sort of all of the social and political challenges that the country's facing.
Were you able to talk with residents there about what their lives are like each day?
We didn't actually speak to any of the residents of the settlement in any organized fashion. I struck up a conversation with a few just as we were kind of walking by. And I would say, you know, it was pretty similar to the other places, you know. I think the most common thing I was hearing from a lot of folks is, you know, I spoke to, you know, people in the hospitality industry and the tourism industry. And, you know, we think all about the sort of immediate cost of the war. But, you know, there are folks who are trying to drive taxis and own hotels and restaurants, and they're suffering as well. And that was sort of the biggest theme that came out of that is, you know, folks saying, I'm trying to make a living here. And, you know, tourism isn't coming in, you know, and we're struggling financially and economically as a result.
We're talking about a recent immersion trip to Israel and with Rabbi Joshua Herman, Executive Director of Hillel Milwaukee. And Owen Hurd is with us, UW-Milwaukee student, recently on this side-by-side program. Rabbi Herman, you also went to Jerusalem, and I'm wondering what you help students experience in such a sacred city.
Sure. Our time in Jerusalem was spent doing a lot of different things. Some of it was, you know, visiting religious sites and going to the old city and, you know, seeing, you know, both Christian and Jewish and Muslim holy sites and understanding how the three faiths are kind of all right on top of each other in that sort of small area. But also the, you know, current political climate as well. We took a tour of East Jerusalem with a Palestinian resident of East Jerusalem, a journalist. Who writes a lot about the security issues and taught the students all about what life is like for Palestinians in East Jerusalem. And then later that day, we took a tour of West Jerusalem, some of the wealthier suburbs, actually, with a feminist leader who talked about issues facing women in Jerusalem and gave a tour of sort of women's history and the fight for equal women's rights through, you know, a tour of West Jerusalem, and tried to show as many different perspectives on that small area of land as we could, you know, from ancient to modern, from Palestinian and Jewish perspectives.
Oh, and what stood out to your experiences in Jerusalem?
Yeah, so I actually agree with some of the things that Josh was saying. I think that our morning spent with Rami Nizal, the correspondent for the New York Times, that was like kind of the first real Palestinian viewpoint that we heard, and we heard a lot. And it was really nice to hear from somebody who had such a different perspective and like a different upbringing, but still was kind of sharing relatively similar viewpoints. So that really stood out to me in our time in Jerusalem, and that was a very influential part of the trip for me.
A very influential part. I'm wondering if your perspective now here back in Milwaukee, has your perspective changed at all since traveling with the program?
Absolutely. It's definitely more, you know, informed. I don't know if my overall viewpoint changed because I was rather neutral going in. But I feel like I took a lot away, and we were talking about like the purpose of the trip being to kind of encourage more positive dialogue on campus and more well-informed dialogue on campus. And I think that was my major takeaway from a lot of those different viewpoints, is kind of taking a moment to step back and let that all sink in and use it to find your own, or to come to your own conclusions about the conflict.
You were also able to meet with a spokesperson for the Israeli military. Can you explain what you learned during that occasion?
Yeah, so that one was one of the tougher spokespersons for me, because we kind of got to see, I believe this is the day that we saw like a VR walkthrough of some of the settlements post October 7th. So we kind of got to see like a raw viewpoint of the initial tragedy. So that was a rough day on the trip.
Mm. Rabbi Herman, what was it like for you hearing from the Israel Defense Forces?
It was interesting to hear their viewpoint. I mean, to me, it was one of the less interesting parts because they are the IDF spokesperson, so we hear them all the time, right? They speak to the media. And so it was kind of, I think, helpful educationally to sort of put them in contrast to the sort of, just day-to-day people that are living their lives and see what's an official viewpoint as opposed to sort of what is just kind of people's genuine experiences living day-to-day. That being said, you could see them crack every once in a while and show that they're people too. These are folks who, young soldiers living on an open base, and they're still going home and worried about their friends and families and things like that too. So in that sense, it was kind of interesting. And the other part that was interesting to me was, trying to ask them a little bit about the sort of information aspect to the current conflict, that it's not just a military battle, but it's really a battle for hearts and minds, and a lot of it's playing out on social media. And how is all that working, and what's the role of official sources, what's the role of people who are just taking a genuine interest in the news, and it's what's going on, to sort of be promoting information that's actually helpful and informative as opposed to things that are misleading and shut down conversation.
Yes, talk more about that. What did they convey to you about the information coming out of Gaza, and what is in media reports, and what might be on social media? What came up?
I think that their perspective was that, they're sort of outnumbered, in that, Israel's a very, very small country, and there's a lot of sort of hostile people who are hostile to Israel, sharing a lot of misinformation online and so on and so forth. It's sort of being a real challenge in that sense, and how little sort of objective reporting is coming out of Gaza right now. And so what we're getting is all sorts of footage and things like that, and it's hard to know exactly what's true, what's not true, what the context of different things are, and the ability to sort of create context and explain things and when it's sometimes somewhat complex, on doing it all on social media, where you have just seconds of a person's attention, is really, really challenging. and just sort of interesting watching, you know, I'm not that far removed from my own college days, but still I'm a generation older than our students, and realizing that, you know, this is so much of how they consume the news. It certainly, I'm sure, has some benefits, but real detriments to not sort of consuming more traditional media forms and long forms of media that kind of dig deeper into these issues.
Owen, how is that for you as you consume social media in your social circles now after you've gone through this side-by-side trip, you've gone to Israel? Have you had moments where you thought that what you experienced didn't connect what you were seeing, reading, or hearing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the main reasons that I went on the trip is because the like mass media is rather biased. And a lot of what you see, like especially on more popular apps for, I guess, my generation, like Instagram and like Snapchat, is just quick snippets. And a lot of it is bordering on misinformation and shouldn't just be like taken at face value and really like used only to like, you know, craft your viewpoints. So that is one of the main reasons that I went on the trip, because I wanted to see and like speak to people firsthand and get more well-rounded information.
Well, Rabbi Herman and Owen, thank you for joining us. Thank you for sharing about this trip.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That is Rabbi Joshua Herman, Executive Director of Hillel Milwaukee. That's an organization that supports Jewish college students and young adults. We also heard from Owen Ward there, a student at UW-Milwaukee who attended Hillel's organized trip to Israel. That program is called Side by Side.
Up on Wisconsin Today, the owners of a Milwaukee men's clothing store tell us about Wisconsin style and make the case for slow, sustainable fashion.
A lot of the brands that we deal with are the opposite of fast fashion.
That's coming up next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about an art festival that kicks off today in Monona and the artist who inspired it.
When you walk into the sun-drenched studio of Harry Whitehorse, it's immediately apparent how prolific he was as an artist. On the left is a wall covered in his paintings, natural landscapes featuring bears or his fellow Ho-Chunk members. And on the right is a piece that takes your breath away.
All right, this is Ghost Warrior. The front half of the horse is metal, and he began that part in the early 60s.
That's Deb Whitehorse, Harry's wife, standing next to the 9-foot horse sculpture. The back half of the horse is styrofoam painted white and brown like a pinto.
Sometime in the 80s, he had, I don't know what you'd call it, a vision that the horse needed more.
So Harry added the Ghost Warrior, an invisible rider.
His thought was it's going in and out of the spirit world.
The sculpture was once on display across Wisconsin. Now it lives in this studio, in the Monona home of Harry Whitehorse, who passed away in 2017 at age 90. Deb still lives here. Harry's family acquired the property in the early 1930s.
When they first lived here, they lived in the traditional, you know, chepudiques of the Ho-Chunk. And eventually built a house, and the marsh back there on the other side of 12 and 18, Harry would go out there with his uncle George Seymour and his other uncles, and they would trap back there.
Uncle George taught Harry about a lot more than trapping. He showed his nephew how to carve wood. When Harry got older, he served in the U.S. Navy during World War II. While on leave, many of his fellow sailors would head to the European bars for a good time. Not Harry.
Instead, he would go into the museums and look at the sculpture. And at that point, he said, well, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be an artist.
Harry returned to Wisconsin to pursue this dream. He went to the Arthur Colt School of Fine Arts in Madison, while also getting his degree in welding at Madison College to become an auto mechanic. He found ways to meld those worlds together.
And Harry seemed like he was working all the time. He had art going all the time.
Gene Delcourt is an artist and educator in Madison. Harry mentored Gene when he was pursuing his master's at UW-Madison in the 1990s. Around that time, Harry had returned to carving wood sculptures, an art form Gene wanted to pursue. So when Gene showed up at Harry's house for the first time...
The day I arrived, he just said, come on in, let's get started. And we started carving little birds. And I spent the whole winter doing that with him.
They eventually began working on large wood sculptures. Harry was commissioned to do works that are still seen throughout the Madison area. He carved pieces like an eagle made from basswood that's now in his studio.
It's a life-size eagle catching a fish.
And the feathers are so, so thin and intricate. It just looks real.
Around the time Harry's wood sculptures got larger, he encouraged Gene to attend wood carving symposiums around the world. This international experience, paired with Harry's passing, gave Gene an idea. Why not start a wood sculpture festival in Monona?
When my wife and I finally said that we must do this, it was a no-brainer for me. It has to be named after Harry because he was so instrumental in me getting into this wood sculpture thing.
The Harry Whitehorse International Wood Sculpture Festival will feature a dozen sculptors from around the world. Gene and his fellow artists will spend the week carving sculptures along Lake Monona.
I hope that this will become part of his legacy. If it's as successful as we hope it is, it'll happen again.
He died about 6 years ago, and it's always been on my mind. I hope everybody remembers him. You know, he has quite a bit of public sculpture here, but not only was an artist, he was a Ho-Chunk person, and you know, he's a Navy veteran. You know, just an amazing individual. Yeah, this just is a prayer, answer to prayer that we're doing something so people remember him and ask about him and know about him and hopefully inspire other artists and young people just to create every day.
Deb Whitehorse and Gene Delcourt spoke with me about Harry Whitehorse and the International Wood Sculpture Festival named in his honor. It takes place in Monona. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
As fast fashion retailers like Shein, Zara, and H&M have grown in popularity, so has pushback against this cheaper form of clothing. Proposed legislation in New York and the European Parliament would further regulate the fashion industry.
In Milwaukee, a menswear store called Millworks has been described as a vendor of slow fashion, clothes that are more sustainable and generally longer lasting.
Jason and Jesse Meyer join us for a look at slow fashion and Milwaukee style. They're brothers and co-founders of Millworks. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jesse, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, Jason, let's start with you. You and a couple of friends co-founded Millworks some years back, 2015. Why? What led you to want to start a menswear company in Milwaukee?
A little bit of a loaded question, but I think the main part of it was we just saw a void for what we were looking to do. And, you know, especially in a city like Milwaukee, things kind of get looked over. So it was something that my brother and I approached our lifelong friends who are also our business partners. And we said, hey, let's just do it.
Jason, paint us a picture of who your, you know, typical customer might be, if there is such a thing.
Yeah, you know, it is across the board, but our, you know, the demo that has really kind of like risen to the top is probably the, you know, 30 and older. And it tends to be somebody who's a little bit more comfortable in their career right now. They're fortunate they get to travel a lot, or they enjoy traveling. As of lately, I would say the last couple of years, we've been kind of thrown into this category or kind of been dubbed a place for like really kind of like cool dads go to get stuff.
Jesse, is there such a thing as a Milwaukee style or even a Wisconsin style when it comes to men's clothing, cool dads or otherwise?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, definitely Milwaukee is a blue collar ethnic city. So you see a lot of, you know, flannels, jeans, t-shirts type of look here. And that is also what we carry, but we just carried it in an elevated fashion.
Jason, this is we're in a world of fast fashion in a lot of ways, right? We get that style now. It's cheap. It's maybe in the landfill after five wearings. That doesn't seem to be your approach here. It costs a little more, but I get the impression the intention is you're going to wear it for, you know, maybe years. Can you talk about your philosophy when it comes to the kinds of clothes you want to put out there?
Exactly. So we definitely sit in the we are a better casual space. A lot of the brands that we deal with are the opposite of fast fashion. A lot of the brands are very small batch. They're family owned. Even the bigger brands that we carry, they have these smaller kind of divisions that are what we deal with. And so their focus is on the fabric, the quality, who's making it, where they're making it. A lot of times when we're ordering stuff from our vendors, it's not even made yet. They make it for us. So it is really kind of the opposite of fast fashion. And our customer has really, really grown to appreciate that because you're right. I mean, you'll come in here and you'll, you know, like Jess said earlier, you know, you'll grab a nice flannel or a nice pair of pants or a pair of jeans, and you will wear them for several years.
Jesse, is there kind of an educational process, maybe some sticker shock when people first walk in if they've been used to that, you know, maybe less durable clothing at that much lower price?
Yeah, for sure there is. You know, and that's our responsibility then to explain to them where that price is coming in, have it be with the labor costs and the specialized fabrics and the traditional milling of the fabrics and old machines that they're all made on in here and in the state, in Japan and here in the States. So yeah, there's definitely a period of sticker shock for some folks, and others they get it right away. So we kind of goes across the board for us.
Jason, you mentioned you saw a lot of different brands, including your store's called Millworks, and there is a Millworks line of clothing. What does it take to design and then get produced your own brand?
You know, that is that's our outlet to kind of have fun and be a little bit more creative, you know, not staring at spreadsheets all day. So that allows, you know, Jesse and I, Tim and Heather, our business partners, to really kind of find out some holes, some voids that we have within our store and kind of plug those with our own Millworks label. Most of the product is designed in-house, and then we send that to factories to get made. And we do deal with a handful of factories around the world, and it's just, it's turned into something that's really starting to grow for us within our, within the Millworks brand, as far as a retail store, online store. The actual Millworks label has turned in to one of our top five best-selling labels that we now carry. So very, very humbling, very flattering. And it's, you know, it's really fun for us to do.
We're visiting the Milwaukee clothing store, Millworks. They're in Milwaukee. They're online. Jason and Jesse Meyer are with us, brothers and two of the co-founders. Jesse, one of the things that surprised me the most is something that Jason mentioned earlier. You want really good Americana-style clothing. A lot of it's made in Japan. How did that happen? What's going on there?
Yeah, so, you know, the Japanese really have a appreciation for American, historic American culture, specifically what we would call the Golden Age after World War II, the 40s through 65, typically. And what had happened is when we got out of manufacturing here in the United States, a lot of the Japanese companies came over and bought all our old machinery, and they took it back to Japan and are now making their products on our old machines with an Americana style, what they feel is their Americana style. What you usually see is like a, again, like through the eras of the 40s through 1965 is what they consider the golden age of Americana style.
Jesse, a next step, I understand, a second store in Portland, Oregon. I kind of get that as the, you know, the size of the city, the kind of the city. But any thoughts of branching out within Wisconsin in physical locations in the future?
You know, we had a Door County store for a few years, and we really enjoyed that. We did close it during the pandemic. But at, you know, at this time, we're just kind of focusing on the Portland store, and we would never say never, but at this time, it's just, you know, one step at a time.
All right, Jason, I got to ask. I've got a brother. I love my brother. Would I want to run a business with him? I don't know. What is it like to be a sibling act and being in business together?
That is probably the number one question we get. You know, Jess and I are really fortunate. We are definitely yin and yang to each other. Obviously, we have a lot of very similar thoughts when it came to building this business and how we were going to build it with our partners. But at the same time, once you start doing deeper dives into what we do, be it the buying, be it the marketing, be it you know, what kind of categories are we going to expand into or cut back on? We can really balance each other and kind of sit down and make each other think and hear both of our point of views.
Jason, any thoughts on the future of menswear? What are you watching for next?
I think the real general for us, the real general view of menswear, and I think part of our success as Millworks and the brand and the brands we carry and the actual physical store is you're seeing kind of this evolution that's like a throwback. Guys are really enjoying coming into spaces, hanging out, talking about the brands, kind of taking things slower again. You know, even our guy, you know, who's very into clothing, he's very into certain looks and stuff like that. He's still, you know, guys in general are still not shoppers. They're, you know, men and women are very different on how they approach that. So for our guy, part of our success is that we're kind of old school in our, you know, I don't want to say we're like a haberdashery or something like that. But we definitely lean in that direction, you know, where you can come in here, you can hang out, we'll talk about, you know, where these jeans are made or where these great boots are made. And, you know, guys kind of feel like in a very small way, they're kind of part of a club. And I think that's the stores around the country that we are seeing succeeding, is that they're kind of taking all that and just slowing down a little bit.
We'll leave it there. Jason and Jesse, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jason and Jesse Meyer are brothers and co-founders of Millworks, a clothing company based in Milwaukee.
Big news, a new WPR signal launched yesterday here in the state, along with a tribute to a very special leader here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
The signal is at 90.7 FM out of Rice Lake. It'll bring our new WPR music service to Barron County.
And there's another big part of the story. The call letters for the new station are WEPP.
That's EPP as in Eugene Patrick Purcell, better known as Gene Purcell, longtime regional manager for WPR in La Crosse, then head of the Educational Communications Board, and then of Wisconsin Public Media, frequent voice here on WPR.
Jean died after being struck by a negligent driver in 2021. The new call letters honor his huge contributions to WPR.
I miss Jean every single day here. I can't think of a more perfect tribute than a radio signal with his initials. Thanks to everybody who made this happen, and Barron County, enjoy the great music.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.